The House Judiciary Committee will come to order, and we're going to take up Senate Bill 385A first. I'd like to have counsel explain the bill, and then we'll call. You have five people signed up to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 385A comes to you from the, I believe, Senate Agriculture Committee. Defines, and it's sponsored by Senator Farioli and Senator Messerly. Defines eco-sabotage as a felony offense which unlawfully interferes with agriculture production, surface and underground mining, protection, restoration, and management of wildlife habitats, waterways, coastlines, farmlands, and forests, the work of a person engaged in research, education, or advocacy of listed activities. And what it basically does, it extends the statute of limitations out for an additional 5 years.
Thank you, counsel. I'd like to have the senator come forward and perhaps Mr. Shepard also, and constitute our first panel for this afternoon. Put you both in good company.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the panel, thank you very much for hearing the bill. First, I'd like to express some appreciation to the chairman of the Senate committee who worked the bill. Our Senate Natural Resources Committee chairman took an interest in this bill and I think improved the bill. As the committee administrator, Mr. Taylor, indicated, the bill does several things. First of all, it defines eco-sabotage. It extends the statute of limitations by 5 years, and it adds RICO statute provisions, Racketeering Influence and Corrupt Organization Act statutes. Let's talk just for a moment, if I may, committee members and Mr. Chair, about the need. Oregon is, unfortunately, a target for eco-sabotage, and it's been that way for many decades. As a matter of fact, the only comprehensive article that I'm aware of done in September of 1999 was a four-part series by the Oregonian. And at that point in time, they documented $43 million worth of damage in more than 100 incidents since 1980. And some of those incidents involved arson, firebombings, attacks on logging and mining equipment, destruction of headquarters of Forest Service offices and sawmills, headquarters of forest products manufacturing companies, attacks on farms, particularly fur farming operations, destruction of research projects, especially agricultural extension type projects. So this is quite a significant pattern of bombings, arsons, and destruction, essentially all aimed at influencing people politically. It's an expression of a political philosophy. The problem is that there should be a very clear distinction in people's minds between what is, in fact, protected speech, which is always unpopular speech, civil disobedience, wherein the perpetrator intends to be apprehended, and in that apprehension and prosecution intends also to put the law on trial, and acts of direct action, which in fact can range from minor violations all the way through serious felonies. The purpose of the bill is to try to help define for people what eco-sabotage is, and in fact this bill really focuses on unlawful attacks on ag production. And that would include livestock, poultry, field crops, fruit production, dairy production, fur-bearing animals, timber, Christmas trees, and food fish, surface or underground mining. And Mr. Chair and committee members, as a result of Senator Shields' good hard work on this, also amends into the bill protection for restoration, protection and management of wildlife habitats, waterways, coastlines, farmlands, and forests. So for the first time, we have an eco-sabotage definition that also includes habitat restoration and ecological protection projects as being specifically protected. It also involves protecting persons engaged in the research, education, or advocacy of any of the aforementioned activities. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is truly an equal opportunity statute that we have here. And I'll use this example. The arson that took place on Ross Island, wherein there's a particular person who is an object of interest by the FBI, where three dump trucks were torched. I think Tree Arrow, Mr. Scarpitti, is the suspected perpetrator on the fugitive list for the FBI. He certainly would be potentially prosecutable under this action. But so would the people who went to the Klamath Basin and cut the chains and opened the floodgates on the irrigation project. So it doesn't matter what your political philosophy is, whether from the right or the left or some unidentifiable spectrum. If you take direct action against one of the protected activities that are described in the eco-sabotage statute, if adopted, in fact, you could be prosecuted under the statute. Initially, I suggested that we lift the statute of limitations forever. Because I firmly believe that these are crimes of conspiracy. And criminal conspiracies are particularly difficult to crack. You almost need an informant or you almost need somebody that was involved in the criminal conspiracy to make the decision either to repent their actions and turn state's evidence or to deal their way out of another particular crime or brush with the law. Those criminal conspiracies are very difficult to investigate. And so the amendments that were brought by the chairman of the Senate committee added 5 years. And we think that is a significant enough period of time so many of the details of these criminal conspiracies can be investigated and brought to light. Again, I'll just mention the racketeering-influenced corrupt organizations statute. That adds some additional investigative tools that are not currently available under state statute, and it would add the ability for third parties, private citizens, to bring an action in civil court for triple damages. And it's the first time that perpetrators would face the possibility of a civil action involving triple the damage that they caused through their direct action activities. This bill had good, strong support in the Senate. I urge the committee to consider this bill as an addition to the arsenal that we have to protect not only farming and forestry and mining, but also research projects involving medical health. We had testimony in the committee, in our Judiciary Committee just this morning about Oregon Health Sciences University's deep concern about the exposure of their researchers to direct action activities if they're involved in medical research involving animals. So I know there is a need for this bill. I hope the committee looks favorably upon its passage, and I'll, if I can, answer any questions that I can for the committee. And I know there are other folks here from labor and industry to support this bill. In our committee, or at least in our testimony on this bill in front of Senator Shields' Natural Resources Committee, the Oregon District Attorneys Association supports the bill. It was amended under direction of the folks from the Department of Justice, and they support the bill. So we hope the committee looks favorably in action upon the bill today.
Thank you, Senator. Questions of the committee to the senator?
Mr. Chair, I have some questions. I don't know maybe if the senator can stay by until we maybe the department may answer some of those questions before I ask.
Okay, would you
or
want?
Ted, do you need to leave?
I'll be happy to stay. I'd be interested in the, hearing the questions and helping help answer if I can.
Well, that's fine. Then we'll have Mr. Shepard. Quick question.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going through. If I missed something, I remember the car dealer in Eugene that had all that damage done. Would that come under this?
No.
Mr. Chairman, the Joe Romania firebombing would have come under the statute. There's nothing retroactive in the provisions of the statute, and the people that perpetrated that crime have already been prosecuted.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, one of the perpetrators got a 22-year sentence. Another one, I think, had over 8 years, 7-plus years. But I do not believe that they would be prosecutable.
In the future.
Yeah. Prospectively, I think another similar crime could be prosecuted if it involved some of the research facilities or an attack on agriculture or animal husbandry or mining. A car dealership isn't necessarily of the kind of things that would involve eco-sabotage.
Okay.
This is particularly aimed at eco-sabotage.
Thank you. Okay. Clarification?
Yes.
So, Senator, it's your understanding, based on what you know of the definition, it would not include the fire at that car dealership as compared to if it was a dealership in maybe farmery equipment where it may.
Yeah, I believe that that is correct, Mr. Chairman. I think that there are some crimes that certainly would not be prosecutable under these statutes, and I want to make this clear. There are statutes on the books to prosecute almost every one of the crimes that we mentioned. But the issue of eco-sabotage and adding the research facilities and the habitat restoration aspect doesn't currently exist in statute.
Follow up.
You may.
Since we're here, we're just going to ask the question. I mean, the one thing, Ted, that I have a concern with is that we're establishing a new set of statute limitations really for this segment or subset of instances. So if it's a kid, let's say, who lives on a farm, he goes over to the neighbors and he takes a tractor. That'd be unauthorized use of motor vehicle. The statute of limitations for that kid would be 8 years, as compared if he went into town and stole someone's car, it would only be 3 years.
Mr. Chairman, I think the I don't know what comfort level you would have with this, but I think the prosecutor in that case would be stretching a little to try to make unauthorized use of a motor vehicle into an eco-sabotage crime. So I would think that the grand jury would have difficulty indicting under that set of circumstances. Now, if the individual stole the tractor and decided to plow under an agricultural research station, I think that would be a very appropriate response.
Okay, let me continue the hearing with Mr. Shepard's comments. And Senator, if you have time to stay, you'll have the benefit of counsel, too.
Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw and listen to the testimony. I thank you very much for the consideration.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. As Senator Farioli has indicated, we testified in support of the amended version of the bill and, indeed, at the direction and request of the chair of the Senate committee did work on the amendments that bring the bill to you in the form that you have before you. Other than indicating the Attorney General's support and making myself available for questions, that's really all I have to say about the bill. I might say, in response to the question regarding the applicability of this to the car dealer, I do agree with the answer that this would not extend to an ordinary car, commercial retail sale context, and indeed I'm not certain that it would extend to the sale of farm equipment itself, because the language of the bill speaks of the definition, the actual production of the agricultural products in question.
Questions of the witness?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Representative McPherson.
Mr. Shepard, I want to see how this fits into sort of a larger context of statutes of limitations. I mean, the purpose of a statute of limitations is to cut off the prosecution of offenses based on the facts having gotten relatively old and cold. And is this, would this be consistent with other patterns of RICO prosecution or conspiracy offenses generally to have 5 years added on to what is otherwise the applicable period?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the racketeering statute itself, even without these amendments, does contain a rather unique statute of limitation provision. And the way that works is, this committee remembers, I think I previously used the analogy to an animated flipbook by way of describing the racketeering statute, each page in the flipbook being an individual criminal offense as a snapshot of that. And then in a racketeering prosecution, for example, the image is that you flip through that and it shows the criminal organization in motion. And because of that quality of a racketeering case, the statute of limitations applicable to racketeering prosecutions allows the action to be brought within a specified number of years of the last page in that flipbook, the most recent of the criminal offenses. In effect, that allows the person to be prosecuted for the conduct that otherwise might be barred in the first of the pages in that flipbook. So by connecting up those pages, and they must be connected within a certain period of time of each of the prior ones, in effect, the statute of limitations in a racketeering case is much longer than it ordinarily would be. So I think in the broad picture, at least as to the racketeering context, an extended period of limitations is not unique, the statute does provide for that already.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
You may.
Am I hearing that if we were to go forward with a change that makes the eco-sabotage a RICO offense and did not have the five-year extension of the statute of limitations that's contained in the A. and Gross version of the bill, that there would nevertheless, even by virtue of it having been made a RICO offense, then whatever the applicable statute would be for the underlying crime would be tacked on to the last offense. So it would already have that characteristic.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, yes, I think that would be a different policy choice than is currently in the bill. As you recognize, the bill extends the statute of period of limitations for not only for racketeering offenses, but for other offenses as well that have the character of eco-sabotage. But you're correct as to the racketeering, the subset of racketeering prosecution that has the character of eco-sabotage is defined in the bill. You could separate that and make that a separate policy choice than the extension for other offenses.
Further question, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. You may.
So if one had a pattern of conduct that was, say, spanned a five-year period itself, does that mean then that the earliest offenses within that pattern of conduct that would have then be a RICO offense would have the otherwise applicable statute, which would be from the last of the events that were part of the pattern of conduct, plus 5 years, so that in effect it would be maybe plus 10 years in that example if you had a five-year pattern of conduct. So the facts from the first of the offenses might be then 10 years plus the underlying limitation period. Out of date before prosecution began.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I think the best thing to do is return to the language of the racketeering statute that currently sets out the statute of limitations for such prosecutions, and it happens to be reprinted on page 5 of the bill beginning on line 20. And that provision specifies that a racketeering offense may be commenced at any time within 5 years after the conduct terminates or the cause of action accrues, and again, the way that works is it's the last conduct that is the point from which the period of limitations begins. So, again, you could, as a policy matter, extend that further for racketeering prosecutions only, if you chose to do that, or you could, as the bill currently does, extend the period for all offenses that have the character of eco-sabotage.
One more, Mr. Chair. So, I think what I'm hearing is that if you had a five-year period of conduct that constituted eco-sabotage, then under this bill, that could be prosecuted for up to 10 years after the end point of that pattern of misconduct, but the oldest facts within the pattern could be 15 years old at the time of prosecution, if I'm reading that right.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I think that's correct. I think that would be the effect of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions from the committee? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and both for the department and maybe Representative Shetterly can help me with this. Maybe, Mr. Chair, you can too. I'm curious at the other than the statute of limitations and other than the use of the word eco-sabotage versus eco-terrorism, what the distinctions are between the bill that we're proposing here and the eco-terrorism bill that Representative Shetterly and I brought to the body 2 years ago, I believe now, as a result of the 99 newspaper article that the good senator was referring to.
Representative Shetterly.
I think I can answer. There's really no distinction. I think the crimes that we both established and amended last session relating to interference with animal operations and agricultural research and I'm trying to think. There were three or four
right.
crimes that we either created or amended. Yeah, those would all be subsumed, I think, within this definition of eco-sabotage. So there's no distinction. I think they all would be within this definition of eco-sabotage. And then outside of that circle, you'd have a broader grouping of crimes that may not technically be crimes of eco-terrorism, but that would be the theft of a tractor, that substantially interferes with agriculture, that might not otherwise be prosecuted as one of the crimes that would fall within the bills that we did last session.
Okay. Council.
Chairman of the committee, we probably want to point out we're not really creating a new crime
right.
here.
Right.
I mean, this fits within the statute of limitations. It will not.
That was where my question was, if that was basically what the significant difference, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much both for your help.
In committee, I apologize that I missed the first part of the discussion. I was having to testify on a bill in the Rules Committee. I assume that are we done with Mr. Shepard's testimony?
No,
we've got questions.
We're going to Q&A.
All right. Why don't we go to Representative Przanski? Or did you have more, Representative Jensen?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
All right, Representative Przanski.
So, I mean, again, for the record, it appears that what we're really looking at is just expanding the statute of limitations for a specific group of crimes. And as we've heard, if we're tying this into RICO, we could potentially, instead of just having a 5-year extension to the addition to the current 3-year for a felony, because the definition to be equal sabotage is the offense is a felony and then unlawfully interferes with A through D. And so you have 3 years on a theft of a tractor. Now you're going to have 8 years if it interferes with the production of the ag product. And then potentially you have another 5 years that could be in play if you're somehow able to tie that under the RICO statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I think that's correct.
And can you tell me why on the last section, page 6, under section 3, sub 1, it talks about when the effective date of section 1 is versus sub 2, it talks about section 2. There it talks about this, it would apply to offenses committed before, on, or after the effective date. Seems like we're trying to go back in time to capture a specific, maybe, incident. Do you know why it's worded that way as compared to the sub 2, which basically puts in effect on or after the effective date of the act?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, the answer to your question is that lies in the dual nature of the racketeering statute. It has both a criminal and a civil remedy. The testimony, I believe, in the Senate committee was that it would not be permissible under existing Oregon law to retroactively resurrect a criminal prosecution that has been barred by the expiration of a statute of limitation. However, there is no constitutional barrier to resurrecting a civil claim that otherwise would have been barred by an applicable civil statute of limitation. And so I think the purpose of subsection 1 of section 3 is in effect to say that you could rewrite subsection 1 functionally as saying the amendments to the statute of limitation provided here don't prevent the revival of a civil action. I think that's the reason that they were written in that fashion.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up.
You may follow up.
My reading of that, Pete, is that it seems to me that this is amendments to RS 131.125, which is the criminal statute of limitations. And so it doesn't seem to reflect back to the civil side. And I guess my concern is that are we trying to expand? And I think we have the authority to do that, even though the statute of limitations of 3 years may have already have ran.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we've actually had legislation in prior sessions where we have actually expanded the statute of limitations. I'm just trying to put some stuff on the record as to why we're doing it. Is it really necessary? Was this an oversight?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, let me confess that I think you're correct. Perhaps others know. I know that Ms. Russell of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and I had some considerable discussion about how the effective date of this bill should be done so that it did not run afoul of the constitutional prohibition on resurrecting a criminal prosecution. Perhaps Senator Perioli or she can assist you. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll at the risk of like the student pilot that runs out of airspeed, altitude, and experience all at the same time, I'll take a back at a legal question, admitting clearly that I'm unqualified to do that. I can speak to the intent, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and would be pleased to hear it.
The intent was that in racketeering prosecutions, often you begin with the discovery of an action, and in the investigation of that action, it may lead you to prior actions. And those prior actions could be linked through the racketeering statute to a date that's essentially so far back in time that under normal circumstances it could not be prosecuted. So I believe the mechanism is in the section to allow the chain of facts to carry the prosecution authority back to a set of conspiracies. And what we find in direct action crimes against the folks that we're trying to protect with the statute, people tend to repeat this behavior in different places at different times in a sort of a conspiracy. My personal theory is that people move throughout an area, perhaps the Northwest. They perpetrate in one area, then relocate to another. They have been, under previous statutes, been able to wait out the statute of limitations and before acting again or before appearing again in that community. This would give, I believe, the opportunity for a prosecutor who selected a racketeering influence corrupt organization theory to follow actions back in time that can be investigated, even though they may go to a point in time when ordinarily the statute of limitations would prevent the prosecution. I believe that's the theory under which this dual effective date was developed.
Mr. Chair, if I can ask for clarification. Mr. Shepard, based on what the Senator said and what the questions that came from Representative McPherson, it would seem to me that if the last act was within 5 years of it being brought, you would be able to go back in time no matter how far back if you could tie that this was fit the elements of the RICO statute or not.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand the question.
From what I heard Senator Farrelly say, that they're trying to make sure that they can go back in time to capture whatever instances they could tie to these individuals for some period of time in the past, but I thought the answers to Representative McPherson's question was that so long as a RICO action starts within 5 years of the last conduct has taken place, that you can in fact go back in time and tie that to any other incident before that. And if that's the case, I'm just wanting to make certain, because it seems like what you see on the front page pages of the book of the bill is that we're looking to expand it 5 years, but now from what I've heard today with RICO, we're looking at actually doubling it 10 years. And I again need to make sure I have a record of understanding what it is that we're really trying to accomplish, and make sure we're not going beyond that intent that maybe had been passed through the Senate.
Mr. Chairman, if I could at least help again with intent, if not the voluminous knowledge of the law that I think some of my colleagues have. The intention was to add 5 years prospectively. And the RICO statute that would cover conspiratorial crimes wherever they went back in time. And I believe that's the reason for the dual effective dates of the law.
Thank you.
You bet.
Counsel.
Chairman, as a committee, let me give my stab at this. Let's say, for example, you had an offense that was a felony committed in July 1, 2001, where it's a felony, normal statute of limitations is 3 years, so that would mean it would run out on July 1, 2004. But I read it with this, you'd extend that to 5 years, so they give you a total of 8 years, which means it would run out July 1, 2009. But let's say, for example, so you could go back and get that in, but let's say it was July 1, 1999, the statute of limitations would have run, and the way I read it, could not be opened up. So what it is if the statute of limitations has not run, it gives an extension.
Mr.
But
Chairman.
If it has run, they can't go back and open it up. So for July 1, 1999, that would have expired in July 1, 2002. It's now June of 2003. If it were to pass today and be effective today, it couldn't go back and reach that particular crime.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I should have deferred to Mr. Taylor in the first place on that question. With his assistance, that does refresh my recollection. That's precisely what sub 1 was intended to get at, so that if we, on the effective date, were still within the statute of limitations for a given offense to which this extender would apply, the extender would apply, but it wouldn't revive anything that had already expired.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Just taking off from that lead, though, that would be with respect to an isolated act, but if there were another act committed currently that would then invoke the RICO statute, that prior offense that was part of the RICO conduct, even though it would be barred by Section 3, Sub 1, would be nevertheless prosecutable as part of a pattern of conduct that constitutes a RICO offense up to the ordinary statute plus 5 years under the bill. Is that correct, counsel?
Mr. Members of the committee, I don't know. The question I would have to Mr. Shepard, RICO is a separate crime in and of itself, is it not?
And it is.
I did hear him talk before, but I wasn't sure. For example, let's say you had a series of thefts of tractors at harvest time over a 10-year period, and you then brought a RICO action 14 years later. I assume that you could prove all 10 for the purposes of RICO. Could you go back all the way to the beginning, in addition to charging RICO, charge theft of the tractor as an independent crime, or would it just be under the RICO conspiracy statute?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the predicate acts individually would still be subject to their individual statutes of limitations, so that they might be cut off as time passed. The racketeering statute, because of its serial nature, would allow the prosecutor to introduce evidence of all of the offenses, even the ones that were barred by the statute of limitations, but they would be introduced for the purpose of proving the separate offense of racketeering.
And they could only be charged with convicted of the RICO offense, and those individual offenses, if they were charged with it, had happened within the statute of limitations period.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, that's correct.
Thanks.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I get this, it's the... If your theory is RICO, you have to establish a pattern, and even though you've passed the statute of limitations, you could still introduce evidence of the pattern.
Okay. Anybody else for this panel? Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Why don't we get Bill, is it Cluding? And Darrell Fuller and Jim Geisinger. Is Darrell stepped out?
He may
right.
Across the hall.
We'll pick him up when he walks in. Bill, you want to start?
Good afternoon, Chair Williams and committee. My name is Bill Cluding. For the record, I represent the Western Council of Industrial Workers here in Oregon. We have 4,000 members here in Oregon. Our people work in the forest and various timber mills, plywood plants in this state. Thank you for allowing me today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 385. Our workers are in the front lines, you might say. We're the first ones that could be harmed by these acts that certain people do to satisfy their agendas. Spiking of trees was the popular thing a few years ago. They used metal spikes, and then they switched to ceramic spikes. There's not a sensor made today that can detect a ceramic spike. And if anybody's familiar with the first thing to do, the timber faller has to fall that tree. And there's a critical time when you've got your both cuts made, and there's a certain time that you have to. Everything has to fall into place at the right second for that tree to go the right direction. If you happen to touch one of those spikes and you dull your chain, you're done. You gotta drop your saw and run, because there's no telling where that tree is going to go. If the log gets into the mill, there's no way to find that ceramic spike until it hits one of the high-speed saws. And the last few months, we've heard a lot of testimony or newspapers and TV about flying shrapnel. Well, that's what these saw blades become. They fly hundreds of feet and embed themselves in timbers. We have had people injured, hurt in both these instances. Cases of electronically jamming our equipment in the woods, sky cars are radio controlled, and they devised ways to jam the signals. Our people have set the chokers and then run for safety. The log is picked up and shot toward the landing at a high rate of speed, and with the jamming, no telling what that log is going to do. Cables are made and designed for certain pounds of stress. If you cut two or three strands, it's almost undetectable. But 2-3 weeks down the road, that cable's going to snap, and it could be at a very, very critical time. Our people are always in the bite when these logs are moving. Dismantling brake lines and steering controls of equipment, our operators have to daily check if this is done. Hopefully they can catch it in time, but sometimes they get on the open road. You can imagine what happens. Arson has destroyed millions of dollars of personal property equipment. Senate Bill 385 has the ability to stop some of these outrageous acts in our state. The stricter penalties, the extra years of limitations, might make people think twice before they commit these crimes. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 385. It can save someone's life. Thank you for your time, and I'll try and answer any questions.
Thank you, Bill. Mr. Geisinger.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jim Geisinger. I represent the Associated Oregon Loggers. We're a trade association based here in Salem. We represent something over 1,000 independent family-owned contractors in the state of Oregon and other businesses associated with the logging industry. We're here, too, to support Senate Bill 385. Probably more so than any other interest group here, loggers are exposed to acts of eco-terrorism and violence almost on a daily basis. The risk is always there. It's not unusual for a contractor to have between $1.5 million and $2 million worth of equipment on a logging site at any given time. This equipment is typically left unattended overnights out in the woods in remote areas. It is extremely subject to acts of eco-violence. And one of the things that's always struck me as being ironic, some of the tactics that are used to sabotage logging equipment, I would have to describe as being very unfriendly to the environment. You start cutting hydraulic hoses, for example, and hydraulic fluid pours all over the ground. And the intent yet of these people that commit these acts of violence is to protect the environment, but it's not unusual for that to happen. Personal safety, obviously, is an issue that's very important to us, and Mr. Kluding addressed many of those issues in his testimony. Logging all by itself is a dangerous enough profession without having to subject your employees to the possibility of having their equipment sabotaged unbeknownst to the operator. The types of incidents that Mr. Kluding referred to have happened. These sky cars he referred to are motorized carriages that run up and down a cable. It's a piece of equipment that's intended to protect the environment, that can suspend logs completely off the ground so they can be yarded through stream corridors and other sensitive environments. And yet the intent of these eco-saboteurs is to cause those carriages to crash to the ground, loaded with logs, with workers working underneath the skyline. in order to protect themselves from these kinds of acts of terror, our members have had to go to the expense of hiring watchmen to be on site overnight when they suspect that they might be the subject of eco-terrorist activities. And frankly, gentlemen, it's time to start holding these people accountable for their actions. It's time to stiffen the penalties for committing acts of violence that put human beings as well as the environment in jeopardy. There's got to be real consequences to what these people do. Violence is just a plain, unacceptable form of political action, and I think this bill would go a long ways towards preventing it from being used in that manner. And for that reason, we urge you to pass Senate Bill 385. We think it's a good law and would be very, very helpful to the state of Oregon and all of the industries associated with natural resources in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Geisinger. Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller with the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. As has previously been indicated in testimony, this bill has absolutely nothing to do with my association or the members of my association. Be that as it may, I'm here in support of the bill for a couple of reasons. One is the case in Eugene, which did directly impact one of my dealers to the tune of over $1 million in two separate instances where individuals associated with eco-sabotage decided to make their political statement underneath the SUVs at Joe Romania's Chevrolet dealership, again causing millions of dollars in damage, over $1 million in damage. The fact that the bill does not specifically cover those acts of violence at the dealership that I represent does not diminish our support of the bill, because the provisions of the bill that would increase the ability of people to go after eco-sabotage as a racketeering activity would likely make it more possible for the people that participated in that activity to be caught for their other crimes, therefore making it less likely that that sort of thing could continue to happen to a car dealership in Oregon. I certainly would have been happy with the bill had it somehow included acts of political violence that would have included businesses that aren't involved in animal husbandry. We certainly would have continued to support the bill under those circumstances. But we believe that even though we're not covered in the bill, that the expansion of the ability of law enforcement and other agencies to get involved and to go after the kinds of acts that include what happened to our dealerships may put those people that have not been caught behind bars for their other acts of eco-violence, and for that reason we support the bill. And I'd be happy to avoid any questions you may have.
All right, thanks. Are there questions for this panel? Representative
Pozanski. It's a general question for everyone, because my hardest problem, I mean, we already have laws on the books to hold these people accountable for the conduct, and two of you spoke about harsher penalties. This bill does not have any harsher penalties. This is only a statute of limitation bill, so it's going to allow for a greater length of time to potentially bring these individuals to justice and be held accountable based on current law. How do we justify a longer statute of limitation for these specific type of crimes that are, let's say, in a more rural area that deals with forestry or with ag, as compared to the same type of conduct that's done in an urban area, such as a building site, a construction site, where someone's causing the same type of mayhem, but because it's within the downtown area of Portland, they are only going to be under a statute of limitation of 3 years as a felony, as compared to, as the bill would provide here, for forestry operation, 8 years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pozanski, I'd like to take a shot at that. When I referred to a harsher penalty, I guess what I was thinking was a penalty under existing law versus not having any penalty at all. And by not extending the statute of limitations, you're going to increase the risk that these people are going to get away with their crime scot-free. And the difference between an act of violence 40 miles from any human civilization versus one that's done in a metropolitan area is that it's just a lot easier to get away with it. And I think that by extending the statute of limitations, you're going to give law enforcement a greater opportunity to find the people that commit these acts. It is not that hard to escape authorities if you're skilled in outdoor skills at all. And as far as our industry goes, that's where these crimes largely occur. Yes, office buildings have been burnt down, but the people I represent, their greatest exposure is out in the woods. And my justification for supporting a longer statute of limitations would be to give law enforcement a better opportunity to find the people and prosecute them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, if I can perhaps try to answer the second part of that question, it seems to me that this is somewhat analogous to hate crimes, if you will. We live in a state and a nation where people who commit acts of violence against people based on their religious or ethnic background or their sexual orientation often receive higher penalties if somebody was assaulted for that reason than if they were assaulted simply for the reason of being robbed. We recognize in law that the reason why somebody does something often is significant enough to attach to it additional penalties. And I think what we're doing in this case is to recognize that when you have an organized group of people who, rather than using legal political opportunities to indicate their preferences, choose violence as their method of operation, that we want to attach to that sort of political statement an additional measure of protection to the people that are subject to that kind of crime.
Mr. Chair, if I can just a point of clarification, though, Darrell, if you have an individual who's committing that type of offense, a hate crime, the statute of limitations is going to be the same as if it was just a straight assault that wasn't based on their perception of someone's sexual orientation, their nationality, or whatever. And I would come back with the question of what if you had this same type of group who does not like the production of meat, and instead of doing it on the farm, they go into a city and they torch a restaurant because they sell or they serve meat. I mean, to me, this is not going to be covered, that those areas, because they're not in the production of the livestock poultry. They're serving it, and you can have the same. To me, I'm just trying to get that balance of making certain that we are, well, I guess I'd say balanced on any of these types of conducts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, I mean, you're correct in my analogy between eco-sabotage and hate crimes. I realize that under hate crimes it's not a larger statute of limitations. It's rather a different kind of penalty. But I was using that same sort of context in terms of the reasoning behind expanding the statute of limitations in this case would be that we're attaching a special circumstance, if you will, as the reason for expanding the statute of limitations. My assumption is that the reason why the bill is written as tightly as it is to try to get to the constitutional 16 and 31. Again, I indicated that we would be in support of an expansion of the bill to cover acts of eco-sabotage that would include places like restaurants and car dealerships, and if you would entertain such a motion, I would be in support of that kind of amendment. But I think the goal here is to take a first good step and see where that takes us, and maybe if, because of the racketeering provisions in here, they're able to go after and break up some of these rings of eco-sabotage, you wouldn't necessarily need to expand it. Perhaps 2, 4, 6 years from now, the legislature may want to readdress this issue and see if maybe there should be expansions of this crime, if in fact it seems to be working. But I agree, there are things in there that are missing that may be appropriate.
Thank you.
Any else for these three gentlemen? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Kelly Stoner. You're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Stoner. I am the director of a not-for-profit group based in Oregon that monitors and reports on eco-terror activity. That group's name is Stop Eco-Violence. For a better part of a decade, a sophisticated, increasingly well-funded, and potentially deadly campaign of terror and intimidation is being relentlessly waged by shadowy fanatical operatives against targets in the United States. Unlike the specter of international terrorism which we all live under, these violent criminal acts are being planned and carried out by Americans on American soil, all in the name of an environmentally motivated agenda to force social and political change. Oregon is by no means a stranger to the destruction and sabotage eco-terrorists have left in their wake. And make no mistake, this ever-present threat to safety and well-being of law-abiding citizens and to the welfare of our local communities will simply not go away on its own. The Earth Liberation Front, the Animal Liberation Front, and other rogue elements in the environmental movement have used brute force, intimidation, and violence to promote an agenda that can be only described as radical. They attack government buildings and homes and businesses and research labs with firebombs, Molotov cocktails, and timed detonation devices. Eco-terror operatives inflict far more than property damage, however. They terrorize people, often into silence, fearing for their lives and the lives of their family. My own family was once a target of such harassment because of my father's research in environmental toxicology. It has been estimated by the FBI that since the late 1990s, there have been more than 600 known acts of ecoterrorism, resulting in damages of more than $43 million. In Oregon alone, there have been 30 major strikes in recent years, causing again both economic hardship and social harm. These figures do not include the numerous acts of eco-terror that go purposefully unreported or the sizable number of the anonymous letters and phone calls to individuals that threaten physical assault. Eco-terrorists are not your average criminals, but sophisticated and savvy operatives who collectively have a long and growing criminal track record, both here in Oregon and across the nation. Up until present, ELF and ALF's campaign of terror has largely succeeded in avoiding the long arm of justice. Nearly every act of eco-terrorism committed in the last decade remains unresolved, and too often the trail leading to the ELF and ALF has gone cold. Over the last several years, eco-terrorists have been ratcheting up their violent criminal activities, both in intensity and choice of targets. University research centers, retail stores, fast food outlets, and financial institutions now join the list of traditional natural resource industries already in the crosshairs. And there's just no telling how far these criminals will go. Just a couple of months ago, former Earth Liberation Front spokesperson Craig Rosebrough, one of the more prominent insiders of eco-terrorism, told the Willamette Week in Portland point blank that he fully advocated the use of violence and terrorism as a means of forcing social and political change. Assassinations and the direct targeting of people, according to him, can be justified. This sentiment appears to be growing within the eco-terror movement. Last September, the ELF sent out a communique claiming a recent arson attack against a U.S. Forest Service research station in Pennsylvania. Not only did they boast about the extensive damage caused by the firebombing, but it contained a thinly veiled threat that, and I quote, "Segments of this global revolutionary movement are no longer limiting their revolutionary potential by adhering to a flawed, inconsistent, nonviolent ideology, and where it is necessary, we will no longer hesitate to pick up the gun to implement justice." The Earth Liberation Press Office has neither retracted nor denied this definite shift in its public stance that people would not be intentionally targeted. The floodgates may now be opening even wider. To be sure, eco-terrorism is a national problem, and our nation is made up of many communities, towns, and cities who have been affected. Today, we gather to discuss what can be done to prevent the social and economic harm eco-terrorism has inflicted to people, businesses, and institutions in the state of Oregon. As testimony given today has demonstrated, Oregonians and local businesses have been victims of eco-terror firebombing, sabotage, and harassment. The Earth Liberation Front's official North American press office was, at least until recently, located in the city of Portland, and support for the eco-terror movement remains strong here in our state. When you consider these facts, one can argue, and many already have, that Oregon is an epicenter of eco-terrorism. As such, we have a responsibility to combat this dangerous movement. It should be noted that individuals that make up these eco-terror movements are not cut from the same fabric as those individuals who work through legitimate, peaceful means to protect our environment. It would be a serious mistake for anyone to dismiss these hardliners as just misguided college kids. Again, these people are hardened criminals. They are dangerous, they are well-funded, they are savvy, sophisticated, and stealthy. And if their violence continues to escalate, it will only be a matter of time before their tirade of terror results in the loss of human life. Stop Eco-Violence applauds the efforts of Senator Ted Ferrioli and his colleagues in the Oregon legislature to make eco-terrorists accountable for their criminal actions by advancing Senate Bill 385. It sends a clear message to those who would use violence in pursuit of their own agendas that if you burn it, spike it, sabotage it, or destroy it, we will use every means at our disposal to ensure your arrest and successful prosecution. We will not rest until we have answered for your crimes. For far too long, law enforcement has been forced to pursue eco-terrorist suspects with one hand tied behind their backs. This new legislation is designed to give state and local authorities the tools they need, and importantly, the time they need, to build solid, effective cases that will result in criminal convictions. We urge you to support Senate Bill 385. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Stoner. Are there any questions for Ms. Stoner? Thank you very much for your testimony. Martin Taylor.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here today representing the Sierra Club of Oregon. The Sierra Club of Oregon wants to start with a short preface, which is to say that in no way do we condone the behaviors that you've heard described. Arson, certainly anything that has the potential of harming an individual or threatening an individual's life, is completely unacceptable to our association. And those are all crimes that should be punished, and we have laws to punish those. Also, by way of a preface, I'd like to say that we do appreciate much of the good work that went into this bill on the Senate side. I think from the very beginning, Senator Ferrioli took a very responsible step in changing the language of this bill from eco-terrorism to eco-sabotage. I realize that you had a bill 2 years ago in 1999 that is referred to as eco-terrorism. I think in light of the events since 1999, terrorism brings a very different connotation to it, that our society understands that terrorism is really a war against us and our values as a country, and that it's something that is now probably more provocative than this statute ought to portray. And the term eco-sabotage is probably a more appropriate fit for what we're talking about today. I also appreciate the work that both Senator Shields and Senator Ferrioli did to try to create some balance in this. This bill now does have a door that swings both ways. It identifies folks that are committing acts that are intended to have a point of view that is pro-environment. It also has acts that are intended to do illegal activities that have a point of view that is anti-environmental or concerned about environmental protections or restorations. And I think that there was a deliberate attempt to bring acts of peaceful civil disobedience out of this bill, things like protests and tree-sitting and standing in front of log trucks and things that one may not feel good about, but recognize that there are far less serious crimes than arson or assault on a person's life. But with that preface, we still have some concerns about this bill, and we want to raise those concerns for this committee's consideration. The first is that this is a very quirky law you're looking at. It's an eco-sabotage crime that really doesn't have a penalty attached to it, and it's relatively unique that way. And furthermore, it's a crime that's put into a strange place in the law. It's actually put into the statute of limitations section of the law. This is particularly quirky because you have something called eco-terrorism in the law, which seems, it seems very much like eco-sabotage is in fact an extension of your eco-terrorism law, which is an actual crime and is actually in the criminal code, and that some consideration should be made into how to take these two different laws and make them a single statute. The second point is that the act of eco-terrorism is a felony-level offense, and there are things about the eco-terrorism law that may, in fact, catch civil disobedience. Eco-terrorism, the eco-terrorism law, and again, I want to start by saying that I am not an attorney and I am not an authority on this, and I would very much have been more comfortable having an attorney sitting in front of you to speak more intelligently on things like RICO and the eco-terrorism law, but on the short notice that we now are operating under, I wasn't able to bring someone to you. So I am making this statement, believing it to be true. The eco-terrorism law is an interferes with crime, and some of those things that interfere with, say, agricultural production may, in fact, not be felonies in their own right. They're not felonies because they're qualified as eco-terrorism, but they may, in other contexts, that if you weren't, let's say, in front of an agricultural facility, be simply considered acts that were misdemeanors or some other act of civil disobedience. I think it's important that we try to craft a law that doesn't capture things that are nonviolent, peaceful acts of civil disobedience. They can still be punished as crimes in their own right, but they shouldn't be an elevated crime. The next thought on this is that we're a little concerned about how these RICO statutes could be enforced. And again, I'm not an expert on RICO. We'll try to provide a legal analysis to this committee from folks who are. But one of the problems that law enforcement has in trying to track down the ELFs and the ALFs, these are organizations that use pretty extreme, what Senator Fiorilli described as direct action, to make a political statement. Those groups are very hard to track down, in part because they don't have staff, they don't have offices, they don't have mailing lists. These are really informal groups, and while we don't condone their behavior, we're a little bit concerned that it's entirely possible that there could be individuals who are a member of those groups who also pay their $15 membership dues to the Sierra Club or Greenpeace or other groups that don't condone or encourage violence. But we're concerned that we don't want to get caught up in this bill when we certainly don't in any way condone or encourage violent activities. And then there's sort of the second level of that same concern around RICO statutes, which is so much of this has to do with the kind of enforcement that you see. Ms. Stoner, for example, came with a point of view that sees these as really terrorist cells, which I imagine some of them probably see themselves that way. But if you take a very strong point of view about who these folks are, your investigations could reflect that as well. I think that you could see a potential that you're deposing or subpoenaing or any other way investigating groups that are not condoning these behaviors simply because you have an overzealous pursuit of these groups. We would love to see these folks caught. They frankly don't do folks who care about the environment any good by committing acts of violence. But at the same time, we would hate to have an overzealous pursuit of those folks end up causing harassment of mainstream organizations like ours. And then I think there is still a lingering constitutional issue, and it simply comes from a lot of the statements that you've heard today. Folks have described this bill, the chief proponent of the bill, Senator Fiorilli, described this as a bill that deals with political philosophy. You had testimony from Mr. Fool saying that these are folks making a political statement or pursuing political violence. I don't think there's any disagreement. This is a bill that's trying to get at a political motivation. And then you have a constitutional question. If this is about a political motivation, are you creating a crime that essentially says, if your political motivation is X, is protecting the environment, you're more more likely to get penalized under the law because the statute of limitations is longer, because we're going to use RICO statutes with you, rather than if your political motivation for committing a crime is something else. And there are many organizations that use political violence that are, in fact, far more violent than any of the things that you've been talking about. If you look at groups that are very wrapped up in the abortion debate or very wrapped up in the anti-government debate, you see far more extreme acts. We just caught an individual, Mr. Rudolph, that, you know, exemplifies the most extreme political expression through violence. I guess the only question here is, are you treading into some territory where you're essentially saying that some kinds of political violence are more serious than others? we're not condoning political violence, but I think it's very hard for groups that protect the environment not to feel a little bit like this is in part motivated by folks who just don't like environmentalists. And I think it would be a better statute if you said it is unacceptable to commit acts of political violence for any reason. And instead of calling it eco-terrorism, call it political terrorism. Or instead of calling it eco-sabotage, call it political sabotage. I think that that creates a far more level playing field if you want to go down this road. Finally, I think that there are some unintended consequences that are implied in this bill. Take, for example, two dormitories on a college campus, one a fraternity and the other a group of young hippies. And they both commit the same act. One of them goes and says, let's go cow tipping and steal a tractor and drive it through someone's fence and have all the cows run out into the street, into the universe. If that's a fraternity and motivated by tomfoolery, they, in fact, under this law, probably are committing an act of eco-sabotage. If they're a political dorm doing it because they just read the Monkey Wrench Gang and they thought that would be a kind of cool political thing to do, they're also caught under this law. And if those folks in the hippie dorm are members of a mainstream environmental group, what possible jeopardy are they subjecting that mainstream political group to? Those are the kinds of questions we think need to be fleshed out in this discussion. I guess my last question to you is, will this actually deter folks? I mean, would either of those groups of young students say, gosh, have you heard about the statute of limitations? You know, if we go cat-tipping now, maybe we're going to be exposed until we're 36 rather than 31. I don't know. But I think that you've got two very different clusters of people that are going to be impacted by this bill. A small, and I understand well-funded and stealthy organized group of terrorist cells like Alpha and Elf, and you've got another much broader group of folks that do stupid things. Neither of them should be condoned. One of them belongs under the existing prosecution for arson or cow tipping or whatever they're doing. And the second deserves a much more serious investigation. And I would urge you to create a vehicle that addresses this group without holding this other group in greater jeopardy because of your concern with these folks.
Representative Shelley.
What's cow tipping?
Cow tipping? Oh. I actually never engaged in cow tipping, but apparently it was quite popular among my peers at Willamette University. It's cows apparently aren't swift when they're sleeping, and they sleep standing up. So if you get a good running start, you'd knock them over. There are probably experts in this room. I'm not really one of them.
How long ago was it that you're in college, so we make sure the statute of limitations?
Yeah.
That's right. I plead innocent to cow tipping, but that was about 12 years ago.
Never heard of this.
You've never heard of cat tipping?
No.
I thought a boy.
I think it happens in your district, actually. I could be wrong.
Familiar, yeah. I think it's a regular. Group yeah, it's a cow over.
Doesn't he get back up a little bit?
I assume. I've never done it.
I think boy from Bandai, I can't believe it.
Yeah. Maybe the Farm Bureau representative is here to help you with that.
How about that?
We raise cows, so it costs money if you tip them over. All right.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes, questions for Mr. Taylor.
Well, not a question, but he does raise an issue. I think there's an element of overbreadth and underbreadth in this. For instance, if you look on page 3, for the purpose of this section, an offense constitutes a sabotage if the offense is a felony. And now, to correct Martin, we don't have a crime of ecoterrorism. That was sort of just a label that we applied to colloquially to several statutes last session, and at least some of those are misdemeanors. I think tree spiking is a misdemeanor. Representative Brzezinski, do you have the list there, or Bill Taylor? So, you know, so some of those crimes that we intentionally created last session under the ambit of of ecoterrorism would actually not be covered by this. Whereas, I suppose a robbery that waylays a environmental advocate on his or her way down to the Capitol could be prosecuted as a eco-sabotage crime.
Representative Brzezinski.
Look, I went through this before our hearing today. Interference with agricultural production or operation, is a Class A misdemeanor, but as compared to interference with ag operation research, is a Class C felony. Tree spiking is a Class C felony, and interference with livestock production is a Class C felony. So it looks like the one that was not a felony was just the operation of ag.
Well, and this raises the question, and I was going to ask Pete to come back up and talk about it, but since the committee's on this point, if you look on page
3 of the bill under the new subsection 9 in section 1. For purpose of this section, an offense constitutes eco-sabotage if the offense is a felony and unlawfully interferes with, and then it gives this list. And so the point that I think Martin made about the, you know, letting the cows out or, you know, stealing the tractor, if it wasn't, there's sort of not an intentional component there. You know, you could steal the tractor without the intent that it was going to have an impact on the production of or interfere with the production of livestock, poultry, field crops. I mean, so you could do it without the intent that it had that impact, but we're still going to call you eco-sabotage in this. And so I've been sort of, as I've listened to the testimony and been reading again the language of the bill, wondering about the intent component there, because you could have a situation where, you know, it reminds me of our discussion when we earlier in the session about that arson situation. You know, if you burn the barn down, a couple of kids playing with matches, you know, how do you want this to happen? I mean, if you've got a kid who, you know, steals the neighbor's tractors for sport and that causes the guy not to be able to go out and do what he was going to do the next morning, Does that, and do we want that to constitute eco-sabotage when his intent was just to joyride the tractor?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I had similar views. I might summarize my points by saying first that, you know, I don't see the nexus between the underlying crime, the underlying felony, and the acts of interfering with the production of agriculture and types of products. I also don't see that there's a culpable mental state for the act of eco-sabotage. I also don't see where this new offense is classified as a felony or misdemeanor. So,
well, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
This isn't a new offense.
Right.
It's
really isn't.
It's a whole array of offenses.
Let me just follow up on that, because I read on line 41 on page 2, so the offense constitutes eco-sabotage, the prosecution may be commenced. So that tells me there's a prosecution for us. I mean, it's a confusion. I don't know whether the intent here is to enhance the underlying felony by creating a larger statute of limitations, or whether we're creating a separate crime of eco-sabotage. I'm not clear on what the objective is.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
My reading, because I looked at that twice, it says if the offense constitutes equal sabotage, and then you go over to page 3 on lines 2 through 8, or through, I guess, 10, that basically, to me, tells me whether or not the offense itself constitutes equal sabotage, such as theft. You could have a theft of a vehicle, and you could have it, if it interferes with the production of, in this case, let's say, field crops, so it's a tractor, then it would be constituting equal sabotage, or could, and that's how it could be expanding the length of the statute of limitation as compared to it not interfering. I mean, it's kind of ironic. I was in hearing some of the testimony. You think about Boston Tea Party. Those individuals would be probably limited to a 3-year statute of limitation because they were interfering with commerce, as compared to if they went out and they interfered with the production of the tea and the crops, they would be potentially there for 8 years on a statute of limitation.
So it's run in either event.
But, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely wrong. But I mean,
no, it's run. The statute is run in either event.
Bring only hope. Bring only hope.
But not under the original version of this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, for
just also while we're kind of defining the universe here, there was one crime I think you did not mention, and that was research and animal interference was another one that we did last session. That can either be an A misdemeanor or a C felony, depending on the value of damage caused. That's 167.312.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And also, I guess, for the record, then, cow tipping would not come under this bill because interference with agricultural operations is an A misdemeanor, and I believe that's what cow tipping would come under. So, I got that one knocked out anyway.
It does seem, in one of the ways, I mean, there's a number of ways to address this issue, at least the one that I raised about the lack of the intent in what would then constitute eco-sabotage for the offense. And one would be to essentially just roll directly back into the bill a direct reference to the statutes that are already there that have an intent element and a culpable mental state element existing in the statute. I mean, that would be one way to fix it, and then it would still include the extension of the additional statute of limitations, and would solve some of, I think, the concern that this sort of hybrid approach creates. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's something we can continue to discuss, and obviously we'd want to talk to the proponents about it as well.
Oh, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Shirley.
Yeah, I was thinking of that, too. It would be a simple matter just to identify those statutes by reference,
mm-hmm.
And then there's no question as to what conduct is included in this this extended statute of limitations. And also, if we're going to do that, it solves the issue of misdemeanor versus felony classification. Some of those would simply not be caught because they're misdemeanor offenses and not felony.
Representative Prasansky.
Yeah, I think we've got the policies that we've used before, like on sexual crimes, rape, and whatever, where we've designated in the statute of limitations specifically back to the ORS of that actual mm-hmm. crime.
Sure.
And it would make it very clear, and it would make it very concise as to which ones had a longer length of statute of limitation, mm-hmm. if that's where we're going to go.
And it solves the intent aspect, because that's included in those particular offenses.
Right, for the underlying statutes. Well, Martin, you've been very helpful in answering all those questions.
Anytime I can help you out.
You added a lot to the last part of that discussion. Dave Fedenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fedenke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. I will try to make this very brief. We had very strong opposition to the original bill that was introduced in the Senate. I signed up as neutral today, but I believe the questions that the committee has been asking are the important questions that need to be considered that were not fully considered in the Senate committee, although there were discussions during an informal work group, which ACLU was not a part of, I should add. For us at this point, the major problem we had with the original bill was that it defined eco-sabotage in terms of political viewpoint, which was clearly fatally flawed. We believe that problem is now out of the bill, and what you're left with are questions and concerns that we believe are very important, which is, number one, should you be creating a special exception in the statutes of limitation for a class of crimes that where it's not entirely clear what's included in those class of crimes? We believe that by limiting the coverage to felony crimes, you will deal with the intent issue by in a secondhand way, but you will not deal with coming to grips up front with which crimes you're actually extending the statute of limitations for. It is a category of offenses that, as has already been pointed out, is both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. And we are very concerned about where this type of special treatment for a particular classification of crimes might lead in future sessions. This is confusing enough. I shudder to think what might happen one or two or three sessions down the road. So anything you can do to make it simpler would certainly be a good direction. We've expressed our concerns before this committee on a number of occasions about the sweep of the RICO statute. We actually believe that Section 2 of the bill does not, as a practical matter, accomplish anything, because as far as we know, all of the crimes that could fit within the definition of eco-sabotage are already included in the RICO statutes as predicate offenses. We're just not aware of any crime that might come under that definition that's not already included. And those are all of my comments, Mr. Chair. I hope they're helpful.
Okay, thank you, David. Are there any questions for Mr. Fahey, Representative Shetter?
Not as much a question, but just a comment. It is true that the four crimes that we dealt with last session under the ambit of ecoterrorism were all specifically amended into the RICO statute.
And Mr. Chair, just follow up on that. Virtually every felony, if not every felony, under the criminal code is already part of RICO. And many misdemeanors as well. But the misdemeanors would not be swept in
right,
as this is currently written, which we believe is good.
All right. Thank you. That's everybody that I had signed up on Senate Bill 385. Is there anyone else here who wishes to testify? You want to come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Greg Addington with the Oregon Farm Bureau. And I will be very brief, and I appreciate the discussion that the committee is having regarding the legalities and what should be considered and whatnot. And I won't pretend to be able to offer you any insight there. I just wanted to offer on a broader perspective our support for the bill. There's no question in the natural resource industry, our folks see this as a growing problem. And maybe more specifically on the research end, genetically modified organisms, biotechnology, these are all things that production agriculture is looking at as a big potential in the future, and it may be the future of the industry. I'm not here to tell you whether that's right or wrong, but I think we need the research to look at those issues. And frankly, that's an area that's really been targeted. So, again, from a producer standpoint, we're hopeful that the bill not only help catch folks that commit these crimes, but may in fact act as a deterrent as well. So, thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Terry?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt, Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We also support the bill and would urge its passage. I think there have been some legitimate points raised. We were involved in the ecoterrorism statute development last session, and I think most specifically the point raised about intent is very important. We used, just as a point of clarification, one of the examples we were looking at was a situation where a youth doing an act of juvenile delinquency throws a rock through a greenhouse window, versus somebody who throws a brick through the greenhouse window with the intent of destroying the research that's going on inside. Both acts are basically the same, but one is obviously done with a much different intent than the second. So intent is important. I would like to encourage Representative Przanski to go forward and pursue expanding these statutes to include other types of crime. On the web today, for example, Earth Liberation Front made announcements that they have burned down three houses, two in Michigan and one in California, and their message was stop urban sprawl. So we're seeing these kinds of activities now crossing over from natural resources into the urban environment very, very quickly. And as was stated before, there no longer is desire to do things in a nonviolent way. They believe that anything justifies the end, and so we will see some deaths, and that's very, very concerning, obviously. And again, we would just urge you to do whatever possible to work out the details of this bill and pass this. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. Are there questions for either Mr. Witt or Mr. Addington? Representative Jensen, you'd move your microphone.
It's not a question, I don't think, there,
okay.
But I had, if I can use the illustration just given of a brick through a window, I think in relationship to both of the events, whether it's a research station or whether it's somebody's a plate glass window in their home, in order to fall under the RICO statute, if I understood what we did correctly, there must be a pattern, more than one occurrence of a similar sort of activity. And I would hope we don't lose sight of that as we try to deal with this.
Thank you. Yep, thank you, Representative. Thank you both. All right. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 385. Appreciate all of you being here to testify. Next stop is a work session on House Bill 2089. And I'll open that work session. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2089 is about to take on a new life. You will see in front of you the dash two amendments, and it changes the original bill, which originally came to us from the Committee on Joint Judiciary for the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force. And this, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, addresses the issue under Chapter 181 of law enforcement in immigration issues. And you have Mr. Shepard here to testify, and I believe several others, Mr. Bedanke from the ACLU. This is a product of a work group that has met for, I guess, about the last 3 months. And I understand there's general consensus along this approach. What it basically says, and I think it conforms to current practice, that notwithstanding subsection 1, a law enforcement agency may arrest any person who is charged by the United States criminal violation of federal immigration laws under Title II of the Immigration and Naturalization Act, cites U.S. Code 18 U.S.C., et cetera, and is subject to arrest for the crime pursuant to a warrant of arrest issued by a federal magistrate. I believe the first provisions on lines 12 through 15 are simply recognizing the reorganization of the United States Immigration and Naturalization Services under the Department of Homeland Security, where they're all now bureaus. But Mr. Shepard is here to...
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General, and with the Chair's permission, I would request that Mr. Fedanke join me, as I think the ACLU has a useful perspective and can be supportive of the approach that we're taking.
Well, the opportunities for comment there are so great. Please, Mr. Fedanke, come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill, the Dash 2 amendments before you are very carefully drawn, and let me make three brief comments about them in addition to the written testimony that I've submitted to the committee. Under existing law, 181850, it's the Department of Justice's view that the text of that language, and I think this is not disputed, the text of the language of 181850 subsection 1 does not distinguish between the expenditure of resources for the purpose of apprehending or detecting a violation, a civil or administrative violation of federal immigration law, and the expenditure of state and local law enforcement resources for the purpose of, for example, taking a person into custody who has been charged by the federal government with a crime based upon federal immigration law. Thus, it's the Department of Justice's view that the text of this statute would prohibit a state or local law enforcement officer from arresting a person for whom there is a federal criminal arrest warrant based on an alleged violation of federal immigration law. And I provided to you a list under the heading Federal Law Background of offenses that the federal government could choose to charge a person with, which would amount to charges alleging that the person had violated federal immigration law. A court construing this statute would first look to the text of the statute, and then under an amendment that this committee achieved last session, the litigants would be able at least to offer evidence of the legislative history of the statutory provision in question. And that statutory history is aptly summarized in the written excerpt that's in the written materials, but in brief, the advocates who came before the House Judiciary Committee in 1987 to urge upon that committee the passage of the bill that ultimately became 181-850, indicated to the committee that it was not their intention to interdict the exercise, the use of state or local law enforcement resources for the purpose of enforcing a federal, a criminal violation of the Immigration Naturalization INS statutes. The language, as I've indicated, is in the language of the law itself is conflicts with that history. And so in the course of doing the review of Oregon law that the Attorney General was asked to conduct by Governor Kitzhaber following September 11th, we identified this tension between the apparent intended effect of the original law and the actual text of the law as it exists and its effect, as I've described, on preventing state and local law enforcement officials from taking into custody a person for whom there is a federal arrest warrant based on these statutes. We identified that gap, if you will, as something that could appropriately be addressed in this session of the legislature, hence these amendments. Now, let me say that we, in the course of examining this issue, we have been reminded, and it has been multiply reinforced with us, that 181-850 as it currently exists, and indeed as we think it would exist following this amendment, protects some very important and serves some very important law enforcement functions. And in particular, in the work that state and local law enforcement agencies do with individuals who may be victims of crime or who may have witnessed criminal offenses, who are themselves here in potentially in violation of federal immigration law, or allegedly here in violation of federal immigration law. State and local law enforcement officials have gotten a lot of very important mileage out of the existence of this statute, because this statute allows those agencies to build bridges of trust with people who are victims of crime and people who are witnesses to crime, and allows the state and local law enforcement officers to say to those people, you can cooperate with me without fear of having your immigration status adversely affect you. And we think, and we believe, and with the support of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and the Oregon District Attorney's Association, that this amendment will not adversely impact that policy. And so we urge this amendment upon the committee.
All right. Mr. Fedenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Again, David Fedenke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon, testifying on behalf of both ACLU and the Coalition to Save the Oregon 181 Laws, which is a coalition of more than 60 organizations in Oregon that has come together over the last year to support the current statute. And I want to reiterate a couple of things that Mr. Shepard said. Number one, we believe that ORS 181.850 was indeed intended to only cover, that is, not to interfere with arrests of persons for whom there were criminal warrants outstanding. And in fact, that is the way, in our experience, that most jurisdictions in the state interpret the current statute. We understand the Attorney General's reading of the statute. We see no harm in making this change to the statute. We believe that this change will not undermine the purposes of the original statute, and we believe in most jurisdictions it will result in no change in terms of how the statute has been implemented on the ground. And it certainly won't hurt to clarify that this statute is not intended to prohibit a police officer from detaining someone for whom there is an outstanding criminal warrant issued by a federal judge or a federal magistrate under the supervision of a judge. And I also wanted to amplify on a couple of comments that Mr. Shepard made, because this statute, I think, is the original anti-racial and ethnic profiling statute adopted by this legislative body. And it was adopted not to provide special protections for people who might be in this country without being in compliance with full compliance with federal immigration law. It was intended to prevent state and local police from treating people who looked or sounded different as if they were suspects because of who they were and how they sounded and how they looked. Because the history behind this statute was that there were several jurisdictions who were engaging in roadblocks with the INS and stopping everyone and detaining people who looked Latino or Hispanic and requiring them to prove that they were legal residents or citizens of the United States without any prior suspicion that, in fact, they might be illegal. And that those practices were not only damaging to those individuals and to immigrant communities, they were damaging to law enforcement because it erected barriers between local police departments and the individuals they are intended to protect. In communities where people are afraid to talk to the police, more crimes go unreported, fewer witnesses come forward, and people are less likely to report suspicious activity. So, again, we believe the current statute is very important for law enforcement purposes in this state. We believe it's also an important statement against racial and ethnic profiling and has had very positive impacts in both areas since 1987 when it was adopted. We do not oppose these amendments.
Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vanke, just for my clarification, I know that there's a coalition. Can you tell me whether the city of Eugene was part of that group? I know that one of the lobbyists is here.
Yes, we have worked very closely with the city of Eugene and other municipalities and law enforcement officers around the state who are not may not be official parts of the coalition, but we've been working very actively in cooperation with them.
And if I could follow up.
You may.
I know that Chief Acting Chief Buchanan for the EPD did have some concerns when the first 181 legislation was coming forward and actually submitted a letter to the chair. Is it your understanding that they are accepting, as you are, that this is just a clarification to make certain that what's current practice will in fact maintain, but it will not have any other impact on the other portions of 181?
Mr. Chair and Representative Brzezinski, absolutely. They share our position on this amendment, and I'd be happy to make available to you a memo that Interim Police Chief Zach Buchanan of the City of Eugene has written on the importance of these statutes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are we in work session, and do you have anyone else scheduled to speak?
Well, I wanted to make sure that there wasn't anyone else here who wanted to address the amendments to the bill, because this is a gut and stuff. And Representative Barker, do you have a question?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Van Dink, maybe you mentioned or answer. I had a conversation with the chief of police in my area who said, I want to be able to go, you know, like the Patriot Act thing, when they went to talk to the Muslim people. He says, I don't want that to be prevented. And would this have any effect on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, there have been differing interpretations of the effect of this statute on what on at least the initial round of those interviews. And I'm sure Mr. Shepard would be happy to chime in here. The Attorney General saw no conflict between this statute and what the Justice Department requested. The City of Portland and some other jurisdictions saw it differently. ACLU agreed with the City of Portland and the City of Hillsborough. But the bottom line is that this law clearly permits state and local law enforcement officials to follow any lead in a criminal case. If they are tracking down a potential lead in a criminal case, this statute should not be any bar. If what the federal government is doing is targeting people because of their ethnicity or national origin and inquiring as to their immigration status when those individuals are not criminal suspects, there is dispute as to the effect of the statute. But this amendment will not make any change to current law in that respect.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I agree with Mr. Fedanke that this amendment won't make any change in the analysis of those issues. The only change that this amendment would cause to any aspect of that scenario is that if an individual whom the police were detailed to go interview was already named as an indicted individual or a charged individual, then clearly the amendment would authorize that to take place. Other than that scenario, this amendment would not change in any way the legal parameters within which those interviews could take place. Wouldn't make it more, wouldn't change the law in favor of permitting greater leeway for those interviews, nor would it constrict it.
Anybody else? All right, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who wishes to testify on House Bill 2089 while we're here in work session? Okay, seeing none, Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2s in the House Bill 2089.
Representative Przanski moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2089. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, since we're talking about these amendments, other than to congratulate Mr. Vedanke and Mr. Shepard and their good work in getting this put together. I know this was coming in early in the session like an issue that was going to cause some problems, and it sounds like everyone's put a lot of good faith effort in, and I'm pleased to see it.
Okay. Anybody else? All right. Any objection to the amendments? Hearing none, they've been adopted. Mr. Przanski.
I move House Bill 2089 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 2089 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Okay, call the roll.
Patterson?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Parker?
No.
Simpson?
Aye.
Hummel?
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2089 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll assign myself as carrier of the bill. That is our business for the day, committee. Thank you. We stand adjourned.
What do you want to do on the first bill?